Hello and welcome to episode 121 of The Great and Crowbar. It is the 1st of December, 2015. My name is Chris Thurston. Today I'm joined by Tom Francis.
Hello.
Graham Smith.
Hello.
And very special guest, Philippa Waugh.
Hello.
That sounded so sarcastic.
You're very special. Look,
not intentional, I assure you. A little bit intentional. So we've now entered December, which is the time of the year where nothing fucking happens at all.
Nothing at all. Nothing ever happens in a December.
In the games industry, anyway. Things will happen in like a couple
lists.
Of weeks.
We do lots of lists.
Lists happen.
Yeah.
We shore up content for the long winter ahead that we may finally rest. But not yet. Because the only game that's going to come out again this year is out now. It's Just Cause.
Just Cause 3. And Just Cause 3. It's launched to mixed reviews on Steam.
The final game of the year from a AAA studio launched to a big old eh.
It's really like mixed reviews on Steam is serious. It comes up in orange. That's how you know your game's in trouble. And I looked at them this morning and looked at the negatives to find out what people's problems were. And they were mostly technical. A lot of the people also had sort of criticisms of the game itself, but they also had technical problems. And so you're never really sure if they're like, if they would have had the same kind of reaction, if it was actually working. Particularly because stuttering is apparently a big problem for a lot of people. And it has always on DRM. If you get disconnected at any point, interrupts you.
That's retro.
Yep. And apparently it's terrible on ATI cards. And I think, is that it, technical-wise?
Is it actually always on DRM? Can't you just play in offline mode and it only exists so it can measure your stats and stuff?
I got to experience this firsthand because I played it. I was actually in Steam offline mode because I heard... Not even a whole sentence, but I read the start of a sentence where somebody said that was a good idea, so I did it. And then when I was playing, it still, in the middle of like a big fight, it suddenly popped up with a dialogue box saying, connection to Square Enix servers lost, try again or go into offline mode. So I went into offline mode, and then, but I'd also heard that if you're in offline mode, that works until you bring up the map. And sure enough, when I brought the map, it wouldn't show me the map until it could reconnect. So I came up with a thing saying, reconnecting to Square Enix servers, and just stuck on that for like 15 seconds or something. And then seemingly only when it actually connected would it let me use the map. And that's like, you know, how you accept missions and or how you find your way to missions, I guess. And how you like unlock gear and things like that. So, I don't know all the details yet, but it doesn't seem good.
Yeah, that doesn't sound great.
I mean, even Ubisoft abandoned that, right? They realized it was a massive mistake and then didn't do it again, right?
Or less, I think.
They did some weird save syncing thing with
Far Cry 4, yeah.
They lost some progress to that.
Uplay just never really worked for that anyway, because it wouldn't really ask which versions of your saves you wanted to keep, which is one of the main reasons you use cloud. Saving is to play on multiple machines, and it would do the thing of like, oh, well, I assume you wanted this one, so sorry.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Anno 2205 that just came out last month is some sort of permanently online, mostly online game as well.
Maybe no one's learned anything. We're still in the dark ages.
The map thing sounds like they're recreating all of the fun of going to a remote location trying to use Google Maps. Oh, well, I guess I should have written their address down.
You've run out of data on your holidays to the Mediterranean. Metal Gear had that problem as well, that it would connect to the internet whenever you brought up the iDroid. So if you were playing in offline mode, the maps and menus and stuff would load faster because it wouldn't try and connect to the internet. But that was optional, at least, rather than mandatory.
Yeah, I remember with Metal Gear, I was starting it in offline mode because if you start in online mode, it shows you like the last 15 news stories as screens you have to okay through every time you start the game, which was fucking insane.
I remember that happening to you, Pip, when you first started playing it, and you were massively put off the game before you'd even got into the main menu because you'd read feeling like it was necessary to do so, read like 15 sets of patch notes about FOB bases.
But it didn't imply that they were patch notes. It just fed them to me as if they were like important information about the game before you got started.
Which you would think would be the only thing you'd put before the game.
Exactly. And then so it was telling me about FOB stuff and I was like, oh, well, I don't want to play a game where I might just get invaded and killed by other people. Dark Souls was miserable enough. Like, I'm done. I'm not playing this. So I just switched it off until I could speak to Chris and say, is there a way to switch this off? And he was like, that's not even a thing. You have to actually turn that on, not like do a thing. So, yeah, that was not a good experience.
The critical response to Just Cause has been also mixed. Probably not as negative, but plenty of 6 out of 10s. PC game was 69?
Yeah, 68, I think.
68.
And go for the Giddy Heights of 69.
Phil Savage, give it something like that for Games
Radar.
3
for Games Radar.
Out of 5, right?
Yeah.
not percent.
Which is, I think it's one of the things where the consensus from our end was that it was decidedly incredibly average game. But it was average in the way that I remember watching Andy review parts of it, and I don't think I've ever seen him that defeated by something. Like, obviously it's like technically okay, but he liked Just Cause 2, but he was so bored by it that it'd become punishment to review that thing, like, rather than even despite its averageness, which is kind of how I felt about Aliens Colonial Marines, actually, where it's like, although that was, I think, probably worse as a product in a bunch of ways as well, still that kind of moment where you realize you're settling into a grind, which is a real shame for that series.
The way I remembered it was that I remember really enjoying Just Cause 1, but the missions were really bad. And then I remember Just Cause 2 being the one that, like, the world is incredible, the engine's absolutely amazing. It ran really well, even on, like, mid-range PCs back then. Looks stunning, even to this day. And has great explosions, and, like, driving and shooting were better than Just Cause 1, at least. And then after a while, and again, the missions were shit, and then after a while, you kind of started to find it a bit empty. I recently read an old blog post of mine in which I say almost exactly that about Just Cause 1. It was just ultimately felt really empty. And Just Cause 2 did, and now apparently Just Cause 3 does as well. They don't seem to have... They don't really know where to go after blowing things up, because Just Cause 1 actually didn't have much destructibility. It was all about the parachute and grappling onto, like, planes and helicopters and stuff, and that was really fun. But it didn't have that kind of, like, you can blow up everything, every, like, different type of
thing.
Military, yeah, thing.
Red
every,
thing.
Every military object, you know, blows up in a different way. And so that was new for Just Cause 2. And then, but they, even with Just Cause 2, it felt like they really hadn't added anything to do with, like, I keep wanting to do, like, a strategy layer where, you know, capturing regions means something and the enemy tries to take them back and there's some kind of reason why you'd want to capture this region and not that one, you know, first. And they seem reluctant to do that. They also seem reluctant to sort of in any way focus less on the story, which no one's ever liked, as far as I know. And the missions have always been horribly overscripted and punishing. And I'm just really surprised that they don't seem able to make that extra step. It almost feels like Assassin's Creed, where they kind of they remake all of the really painstaking, difficult thing where, you know, they have to make a whole fucking city all over again and make it all, like, really authentic and beautiful and real, and then never address the core problems of the series. The difference is I love Just Cause 2 anyway. And so I don't know how I'm going to end up feeling about Just Cause 3. I played it for, like, 2 hours before it came out, and it is absolutely stunning. It's really nice because it's beautiful, but also in a different way to Just Cause 2. Just Cause 2 is very tropical and, well, had, like, desert, ice, and tropical. And this so far feels like sort of Italy or something. Like, it's very Mediterranean and has a kind of different kind of paradise. And that's lovely to fly around. And the wingsuit is cool, I guess, so far. I haven't really mastered it to the point where it's a major improvement. And I've liberated a region. So that involves destroying all the shit in, like, 3 different cities or locations, I think. I think the first one was just a guard tower. And then the next one was an actual town. And then the final one was a sort of military base with some stuff in it, some jet propulsion things that I had to blow up. And they've added kind of a certain amount of gaminess to that. I think in Just Cause 2, you sort of had to hack certain things, because I remember you had to hack pipelines to blow them up. And then Rico would say, take that, you pipeline jerks. And now in Just Cause 3, you have to hack two different things within 40 seconds of each other, and that unlocks the gates to four different things, and then you've got to blow up all of those within a minute and a half, otherwise the gates shut again.
He didn't blow our shit up fast enough. Close the gates.
Yeah. So there's it's the bases are a little bit more than just blowing them all up, but I can already see the limits of the fun of that. And it seems like the everything is tied to how many activities you've done in a region.
Yeah. So according to Andy, one of the reasons he was getting frustrated with it is everything from progression, particularly progression along the critical path, is gated by whether or not you've finished everything in a region. So unlike you kind of using the story to unlock the regions and then going back to the regions to mop up the optional stuff, which is the kind of traditional Ubisoft open world thing, it's more like you mop up all the stuff and then you do the next mission. But given that mopping up the stuff basically refers to shoot the red things, it's a game of shoot the red things forever, which is not necessarily...
So this is the promise there. I haven't played it yet. I've just read John's review on RPS, and that's why he liked it, because he likes cleaning up the bases by blowing them up, basically, and he liked that that wasn't tied to story progression, that he could go direct to the third and largest island and do all that stuff without having to first play through the story missions to unlock it. And I can understand that, if Far Cry 4 had come out and I didn't have to do all the pagan men bullshit in order to unlock the outposts of the second world. But then that only works if you enjoy the mopping up.
I think it suffers from something that a lot of, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, but the other open world girls, other open world games suffer from, which is that as you complete actions in the open world, you effectively remove interactive things from the world, because basically the only things that are destructive, or the only things that are interactive are destructible, and the only things that are destructible are the only things that you have to interact with. So yeah, there's fun in tying things together and finding creative ways to blow up all that stuff. But as you progress in the game, you are steadily reducing the amount of fun in the game, which is a recurring problem with kind of map cleaning games, basically.
That's the other reason why you need that meta layer that you were talking about, Tom, of an enemy force, which is recapturing bases and repopulating them and rebuilding them and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I did have some fun with the new tether stuff. You can now tether two things together as you could before, but now you can do multiple pairs of those, and you can also retract them to pull two things together, which is by itself not super satisfying. If you tie someone to a wall and then retract him into the wall, he does hit the wall and it does take him out, but it doesn't sort of look really impactful or sort of spectacular, because I guess the pulling force isn't that strong. But I was trying to do that to a guy, and so I tethered him. You have to press the tether button on him, keep it held, then release it while looking at something else. So I did it to him and then tied him to the wall, and then I was trying to press the button to contract the tether and knock him into the wall, but I accidentally just hit the tether button again, which shot him with a new tether and sucked me into him, and then did a sort of tether kick on him and then sent him up into the air, but he was still tied to the wall, so he swung around and hit the building on the side, which was way cooler than what I was trying to do.
What's the just cause that you are presumably
there's an evil dictator, and therefore
it's a tie shit to shit.
I think
good.
I don't know where I'm getting this from, but I have the impression that this one, actually, the stuff you're blowing up is generally military or propaganda related, whereas in Just Cause 2, you blow up water towers.
You propaganda blow up water.
Vital infrastructure for people to live, and that was you really showed the regime there. They were trying to supply water to these people, but you showed them.
Because I've never played any of the Just Cause games, and when people mention them, I'm always hang on, is that Far Cry or Just Cause or Uncharted? Because they're all sort of much of a muchness, I think, until you've played them, because they get the same sort of poster treatment, and the sort of, or I suppose Nathan Drake gets heroed, but you look at the posters and you're kind of which series is this on? Is
Rico
the one
looks
with
increasingly
the malaria?
Like Nathan Drake.
Yeah, he really does in the new one, actually. He really has started to look less like Antonio Banderas, which is how he started life, and because he ended up,
which is a shame. I kind of liked that. I mean, it's not that diverse, but it's a little bit different to the absolute standard, main action hero.
Yeah, yeah.
Look like Antonio Banderas. Still looks like a major A-list movie star, but just a different one.
Yeah, exactly. He's also increasingly a man who is affected by different physics. Like, I was trying to figure this out watching him, because the wingsuit really compounds this, because Just Cause 2 had the weird thing where if you were falling from fucking space, if you tethered to the ground at the moment of impact, you would be fine, because by grapple launching yourself into the ground, you would somehow replace your falling momentum with the grappling momentum.
That is a loading screen tip in Just Cause 3. It tells you that and claims that Isaac Newton said it.
At least they're owning it. But it's like, as if the notion that the only thing that is lethal about falling is you not intending to do it.
Yeah.
The moment you're falling on purpose, you're fine. Like, that's the difference between...
It's that thing of, like, if you're plummeting in a car off a cliff, if you jump out the car door just before you hit the ground, then you just walk out onto the ground, you're just fine.
Yeah, different physics. But yeah, like, I remember watching some... Because, like, I think it's that system is kind of graceful and cool with the helicopter and the... Sorry, the helicopter, the parachute and the wingsuit and stuff. None of which makes any sense, because none of those objects do those things in real life. It's just that you sort of believe it when you see it. Until the moment where... I remember watching Andy play inside a great big cavernous warehouse, and I think he accidentally pressed the tether button and ended up just flinging himself into the ceiling incredibly hard. And it looks totally absurd. And, like, Rico is almost cursed to not really stick to the ground like a normal person would. But you know those people who have, like, agoraphobia, where they're so terrified that if they go outside, they'll fall into the sky. You know what I mean? Like, I think he legitimately would be justified in worrying about that.
The controls are really weird now. There's just a lot of buttons to press. So if I want to just propel myself across the scenery with a parachute, I have to find something a little bit higher than me, tether onto it with the left button, and then it'll suck me towards it. And before I hit it, I've got to hit A to deploy my parachute, and that's as last time. Then when I'm in the air, I need to tether onto the ground with the left button. Then I need to hold down left trigger to accelerate the reeling in. And then... before I go too far, I need to hit B to disconnect the tether, because if you attach to a point in the ground, then you keep pulling yourself towards it. Obviously, at a certain point, it's below you, and then you're just sucking yourself downwards. So you need to keep sucking yourself while you're going horizontally, and then disconnect once the angle is not favorable. And every time I do that, even if I manage to get those four buttons right, then the next thing I do is hold down left trigger to tether again, because that was the last thing I pressed to do with tethering. And then that's not the tether button, it's the left button. And I fall from the sky and land.
See, this is what I'm getting at. It's like, maybe the better way to put it is, why don't they just make a game about a man who can fly? Because he can. And they sort of jury-rigged this system for flying. But it doesn't make any real practical sense. And in its sort of overture at realism, because it would be unrealistic for you to not have to detach the grapple cable that you're using to parachute along the ground, then... you know, it creates all this extra complexity and room for error, whereas that basically is a game about a man with some bombs who can fly, right? Like,
there was a Superman mod for Just Cause 1, which just did let you fly, and it was pretty cool. You could go incredibly fast flying, but also the thing I was interested in is you could also slow down and continue to fly. And I would just, like, follow people around the world just flying just behind their head. And it's just Rico in his falling pose. So he's, like, his arms and legs are kind of splayed backwards, and he's just hovering head first just above their head. Just, like, creep people out that way.
You're making it sound like that bit in the Spider-Man movie with Kirsten Dunst and, like, Spider-Man, and it's raining, and then they get off with each other.
I didn't do that with anyone that I can recall.
The unbreakable tether, I guess, of Spider-Man's affections. Speaking of which, what have you been playing, Graham?
I've been playing a number of small things, one of which is called Spiderling.
What a segue that would have been if I'd remembered that.
Which is a freeware platformer, runs in your browser, that was released last year, but I only found out about this past week. And I discovered it because I saw a GIF of someone swinging about in it, because it's a game in which you play a spiderling. Is that a real thing?
It's a baby spider.
A baby spider. You play a baby spider who you can shoot webs and tether onto ceilings.
How do you shot web?
Sorry?
How do you shot web? I don't think anyone else knows that meme. Some people listening to this podcast will laugh knowingly. Most people won't.
I will just look confused at you. And you use that to get around, so to swing around along the ceiling in the underground network that you live within, or to attach rocks to walls in order to drag them into position, or to dangle them over cliffs and place them on buttons and stuff like that. And it's a really satisfying physics interaction. And I really like any platformer or any game that's got a grappling hook in it. And I prefer grappling hooks when they're kind of taut and predictable, because this is a springy kind, which I guess web.
I like my men like I like my grappling hooks. Taut and predictable.
Whereas this is the springy kind of grappling hook. But it just comes up with quite neat little puzzles. So one of which is you come to a cliff face with an infinite drop at the bottom of it that kills you, and there's two rocks in front of it, and just inset into the cliff face below you is a button. And so you just have to attach some web to one of those rocks and nudge it over the ledge so that it's attached to you with the web, and then kind of like try and swing it inwards to get it to land on the button, at which point a door opens at the top of a level and a caterpillar walks out, and then you can tether to the underside of the caterpillar and then swing along underneath it as it walks along across the top of the cave.
That sounds so cute.
It's really cute. And it's got a lot, like the atmosphere of it, other than the fact that it's got creepy as fuck spiders in it. Spiders, some of whom have weird human faces for some reason. And it's about you trying to escape with your friend who's a fly because the spiders are going to go to war with the flies.
I would say they're already at war with
the flies. That's one-sided.
Other than all of that, it reminds me of Knit a little bit, in that there's these kind of like sparkly fireflies floating in the air, and there's little harmless frogs hopping around your feet. I don't know why there would be frogs, some sort of insect, I guess, that looks like a frog but is much smaller than a spider and lives underground. And
there are frogs that small.
Snails.
Are there?
Yeah, there are frogs that are like absolutely tiny. Poison frogs often.
Like millimetres long. Like,
really?
Smaller than your fingernail.
Tiny.
I didn't know that.
Lesson learned.
Like, spiderlings are really, really tiny, so maybe this is like a teenage spiderling. I'm not sure when they develop the ability like to like spin webs and stuff.
And have conversations with their fly friends.
Well, yeah, I'm not really sure the age at which they develop social skills.
It looks kind of humanoid, doesn't it? It's like walking around on two legs.
It does, and like I say, there are other spiders. All the other spiders look much more like spiders, but some of them have like a human face on their back.
Right.
It's weird.
Do they still have a spider face on their face?
I don't know, because it's two dimensions and they don't turn around.
Okay. I watched the video of this. I watched the walkthrough video that shows you how to complete the game, because I wanted to know what it was like. And the way you shoot web out is...
How to shoot web.
It's like a string, and it also has like a sort of limited length, and if it doesn't hit anything before that amount of length has come out of you, it just sort of continues flying out of you as a fixed length string that then just kind of drapes over the scenery. And it seems that later on...
We've all been there.
Later on, you have to use that to drape over the scenery because it's pitch black and you can only see your webs. So you have to sort of drape your web all over the levels to find out where the solid bits are.
Silly string. Glow in the dark silly string.
Very much silly string.
It really is a teenage spiderling.
But hey.
Graham knows what I'm talking about.
The other game, free game, well, it's not a free game, there's a free demo of it, rather. The other game I've been playing is Wizard Detective.
Tell me more.
It's about detecting a wizard.
Oh, shit.
So you're not a wizard?
You're not a wizard who is a detective, I'm guessing. It sounds like you're a detective who is somehow seeking wizards.
Let's ask Graham.
Well, you are able to detect dark magic. So there's a town. It's in 3D. And you're walking around a town. And when you arrive, there's a guy that says, hey, I think you can help us. There's some dude doing dark magics on the populace of this town. We need your help to capture him because you've got a reputation for being able to perform a detect magic spell. So maybe you are some sort of wizard.
Yeah, I guess,
but you're not
that counts.
A dark wizard. And so okay, maybe it should be, fine. You know. I can't tell still whether the title refers to you or the wizard you're looking for, but it's kind of a cross between Westerado, that cowboy detective game, and Where's an Egg?
Oh, wow.
It's an egg detective game.
Yeah. Well, in the sense that it's procedurally generating a world full of people, and those people all have homes and names and relationships to one another and opinions of one another and appearances and stuff. And you walk around town and you talk to them, because before you can perform the detect magic spell, you have to have two followers. And the guy that's like invited you to town, he's your first follower, but then you've got to go find someone else. And if you just walk up to someone and say, "Hey, follow me," they say, "No, I don't know you. Why would I do that?"
Fair enough.
And so you can then talk to them and you can ask them questions. You can say, "Well, how are you feeling right now?"
"Now, will you follow me?"
They'll say, "I feel pretty crappy." And you say, "Well, why do you feel pretty crappy?" And he says, "Well, because I've got an odd face." All right.
That's awkward.
And then you can say, well, you can offer people, you can offer your opinion of characters or any character that you've met or any character by description. If you can, you can say, this blue guy, he's
got an odd face,
way overconfident. And if they know a blue guy that they think is overconfident, then they'll be like, "Fuck yeah, I hate that guy." But you seem pretty all right. And you can convince them to like you basically by asking them questions about themselves, and if they say that they look odd, saying that you like how odd looking they are, and then they'll be like, "Oh, thanks, you seem pretty cool." Hopefully. Or if you repeat opinions that they share themselves, and you also learn kind of the social dynamics of the thing, not just how they feel about other people, but who they're married to and whether their marriage is happy or not, or whether they're annoyed. And if, as you go through these conversations, some people will start to feel comfortable enough with you that they'll ask you to do like odd jobs for them. So one of the first events that happens, which is scripted, is someone gets turned to stone. His dad comes and finds you and says, "My son's been turned to stone." He takes you, that's fine. And then I bumped into his grandfather, the guy who turned to stone. I started talking to him. He hates his grandson, so he wasn't really fussed about that, but he really likes his granddaughter. So he was like, "Well, could you do me a favor? Could you go talk to my granddaughter and find out why she doesn't like me? Because I really like her and I don't understand what's going on." So, I say, "Well, can you send your granddaughter to me so I don't have to search for her and stuff?" And he goes, "Yeah, okay." And wow. So she'll come up and look for you later on. And when she came up and looked at me and I spoke to her, she said to me, "I really don't like my grandfather. Could you talk to him and find out why he likes me so much so I can stop doing it so he'll leave me alone?"
Wow.
And so basically you're kind of toying with the social simulation of this a little bit, but mainly I only got so far as to get my second follower to get to the point where I could detect magic. And so now I can go up to people and say, that's one of, it's presented almost like a dialogue option, but you can detect magic on them. They get a bit offended because you think that they might be evil. And you find out whether they're the wizard or not. And the goal of the game is to find out which one's the dark wizard.
Couldn't you get followers by saying, "Look, I need a second follower to do detect dark magic. And if we don't do this, there's literally a dark wizard living among you, and you'll never know. This is the only way you'll know is if you follow me."
That would be useful. That would be a good shortcut to the game. One of the best ways I found was to say just random opinions about people or about them, to say, your grandson, I really like how calm he is. And they'll go, "Oh, really? I never found that." In which case you don't get any plus or negative, if they don't actively disagree with it, or agree with it, they just haven't noticed, they don't have an opinion about it. But then what you could say is, "I was only kidding." And at that point they're like, "Oh, ha, that was funny. Good one."
What a great joke about my grandson being calm when he isn't particularly.
Little plus comes up at that point to say, "Your relationship with this guy is improved," because they think you're funny. And so you can just kind of do that. That was the quickest shortcut I found to getting people to like me in this world.
Say things that aren't true and then say you're kidding.
Yeah, much like life. Yeah, this served me well.
Is there a limit on what the dark wizard can do? Because if someone's following you, can they be the dark wizard, and can you try your magic out on your detection spell on your followers?
I don't know. I haven't tried to try it out. I haven't tried it out on my followers.
You should try or try. There is no not double try.
There certainly should be a way. It certainly should be possible that the dark wizard is just one of your followers.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would do if I were a dark wizard.
Yeah, just pretend to like you because they know what you're there for.
Because if you start laugh trusting me, then jerks. You'll be... Yeah, I mean, you need me to power your investigations against the rest of the village. Oh, well, didn't find the wizard. He must have gone.
One of the nice things is that all the other villagers do seem to have lives on their own. Like, they've got specific homes. They've got relationships with other people. They've got... They've been married. They talk to one another as well. So little text boxes come up above their head as you walk around town and you can overhear their conversations. So, you know, you walk by and there's a husband and wife in a house and the wife says to the husband, "You're really annoying." And they just proceed to have this kind of slightly dynamic argument about their disagreement over the fact that one of them feels the other one's annoying and the other one doesn't think that he's annoying.
How does it look? You said it's 3D. Is it like primitive?
Yeah, it's very primitive, like cube man. Like, right. Not quite so much Minecraft, like thin, really thin rectangle cube man. Okay. With very pixelated faces, which is why, like, and their pixelated faces can be, like, blue, and they know the color of their own face, so that can be one of the things that bums them out. I have a blue face. I'd be sad about that.
It's like we're all playing Rust.
It's up on Steam Greenlight at the moment, and it's on Itch, and there's a free demo you can download for Windows or Linux, I think. And the guy who's made it's going to release it, I think, for $3, he said, in the coming months. He says that he worked in AAA development and he wanted to do something weird and different.
Yeah. I want to make a game about finding a wizard in a town full of awkward conversations.
Yeah. But it's really cool. I really like the conversation system.
Yeah, it sounds amazingly systemic.
Yeah, and there's like 10 to 15 different questions that you can ask every single person. And then if you like want to offer them an opinion about any of the other people that you've met in the entire world, and then you've got, say, 15 different adjectives you can use to describe your opinion, and they can agree, disagree, or laugh. Super great. The other game, the third game I've been playing, is Subterfuge, which is not a PC game. So technically not within the remit of the podcast, but
it's a lot like a PC game.
It is a lot like a PC game. And I've also been playing it with some of the listeners.
I can't believe you found anybody willing to play it with you.
Well, that was the thing.
Your diary.
None of my friends would play it with me, sadly.
I vowed never to play a game with a genre ever again after Neptune's Pride.
That's the thing. Like, most of my friends, you included Pep, I think, have decided simply that this is not a game to play with friends. Not just not with me. Although perhaps especially not with me. But I did, at the same time, I didn't want to play it so, like, just with complete randoms over the internet, because it feels like it benefits a little bit from the context of knowing
the frisson of fucking somebody over who you may one day have to deal with.
You kind of, like, if it's just random names on the internet, I don't really want to talk to them and have relations. You know, all that stuff.
Relations with us.
Yeah. Whereas if it's someone who I have some sort of connection with them, I feel like I have some context for who that person is. And so the Discord room proved a good source. I just went in there and said, "Hey, does anyone want to play Subterfuge?" And a bunch of them had already played a game, I think, a couple of weeks prior. So they were up for it.
This is the Crate and Crowbar Discord room, which you can find a link for on the sidebar of our homepage.
And undoubtedly in the show notes of this very episode.
Yep.
Quite possibly. Just to quickly go back to Neptune's Pride, didn't you have a pretty terrible experience in Neptune's Pride as well? Well, didn't it put you off it for life?
Because I sort of won.
But at what cost?
I was the terrible thing that happened to other people. And that was the bad experience I had, was the guilt I felt at the end as Kieran and I threw planets back and forth at one another, because I launched a late night attack at him during a sensitive time in his life, perhaps, after we had agreed to call a truce to make peace for all time. And then I realized that there was like 24 hours left and he was going to win if I did nothing, and so I attacked him.
You are one of the reasons I don't play this game.
At which point Kieran came home from the pub at like 1 o'clock and was like, "Fine, well, if you want to win that bad, then here, just take all my planets," and started just gifting me his planets. To which I saw that he was doing that and felt bad and started gifting my planets back at him. And so we were just like throwing planets at one another. And eventually he won and I was second. But technically I won. I could have won if I wanted to.
So when you just said you won, that was a lie.
It was a lie. I didn't win.
Seems like this was Kieran's master plan all along.
The thing about these games, I feel like because you sort of gestured Neptune's Pride and gestured Jet, we should actually explain
what
in simple terms
are.
What you do in these things that people hate.
Well, I'll explain Subterfuge rather than Neptune's Pride and then get into the differences of it. So Subterfuge is a strategy multiplayer game played on Android or iOS set under the sea, in which you start with a small number of outposts. There are three kinds of outposts. There are generators and factories, which are the ones that you start with. Generators fuel your factories. Factories are what make your drillers. Drillers are your weapons, basically. You load them up in submarines and you launch them at other outposts, and if you can defeat their shields and the drillers that they've got defending that outpost, you claim that outpost for yourself. But where Neptune's Pride, at least the build of it that I think we played in the early days, was purely about territorial dominance. Like, in order to win the game of Neptune's Pride I played, you had to just simply claim 60 or 70% of the map in order to win. Yeah. And so in a game of 8 players, you pretty much had to go to war with at least 5 of them in order to win. And it took a month of just back and forth, because every time someone would pull into the lead, everyone else would just team up on them and knock them down a peg. And that just kept happening, so no one could ever quite get a dominant victory. Subterfuge, the way it does it, is it has a resource called Neptunium. In honor of its obvious inspiration. And the way you get Neptunium is you take one of your other outposts, either a generator or a factory, it can be either one, and you upgrade it to a main using drillers. First one will cost you 50 drillers, second one will cost you 100 drillers, then 200, 300, 400, and so on. And that generates a certain amount of Neptunium each day, dependent on the number of outposts you have. So I think you get maybe a base rate for having a main, but then each outpost gives 2 Neptunium a day extra on top of that. Right. So if you've got 13 outposts and 1 main, then you're getting 26 Neptunium a day, and so on and so forth. And that's just a really simple tweak to the Neptune's Pride formula, but a really important one, because it means that no longer are you just throwing units back and forth at one another, trying to get control of outposts. You can reasonably play with a relatively small bit of terrain. Quite early on, I got about 13 outposts, and then I never really expanded much beyond that, because there just simply wasn't any reason to. Instead, you can just hoard drillers, and instead of attacking other people, continually spend them on unlocking new mines. You can also then see, like I should say, where I was playing in a match with 10 players, and I decided up front that I would try not to be as big of a dick as I was in the Neptune's Pride game. I would try to do essentially a no betrayal playthrough of one of these games, which doesn't mean that I wouldn't attack anyone, but meant that I wouldn't forge an alliance with the intent of later breaking it, which was the only way to ever get anywhere in Neptune's Pride, where you couldn't fight everyone all at once, and you couldn't fight people one after the other, because your units would just be exhausted. And so you had to team up with other people and forge these alliances that you knew if you ever wanted to win, you would have to break eventually. In this, I decided I'm not going to do that. And if it means I can't win, then fine, no bother. And over the course of the game, until the last kind of 12 hours where I attacked one other person who attacked me, I only ever attacked one other person. So of this game of 10 players, I only ever attacked one of them, and everyone else, I either didn't agree to do anything for them that I wasn't willing to do, or if I said I was going to do something for them, I did it and I honored the alliance, even though most of them didn't by the end. But that actually served me really well, because it meant that come the end of the game, when I was right up near the top, like first, second, third, no one had, other than the one player I'd attacked, no one had a huge vendetta against me. So while everyone else was just fighting one another, and all the people who had no chance of winning, and so therefore had nothing to lose, just decided that they were going to get revenge on the person that wronged them. They just continually screwed over anyone who had any chance to beat me. So the game actually ended just before I came here to the podcast, and I won.
Huh.
And so I managed to win my first game of Subterfuge against 9 other people by being just kind of quite nice most of the time. And the other mechanic, that the main mechanic that's different from Nature's Pride that I really, really like, is the specialists it introduces. So as well as having drillers, which are just like a purely mathematical symbol of your strength in any fight, and the maths for whether you're going to win in an outpost is incredibly simple. It adds these specialists, which you can hire one of every, I think it's 17 hours or something like that. Your queen is able to do it. And you get a choice of three, and it's a random selection of three every 17 hours, and you can hire one of them, or you can skip that hiring phase, in which you get, you keep the recruitment point. So in the next phase, you'll have two recruitment points. And certain specialists can also be upgraded. So you might choose to spend your recruitment point on an upgrade rather than a new one. And this adds essentially a much more complex strategy to a game that was otherwise just about throwing numbers at one another. So like some of the specialists are assassins, which kill any other specialist that's in combat, tycoons, which increase the output rate of your drillers. There's a smuggler who, if he is on a ship, he doubles the speed of that submarine as it travels between the outposts. And you can use these things in combination, and some of their abilities stack. So for example, you can get Hypnotist, who is able to release the captured specialists of yours from any enemy outpost if they've been taken hostage, as long as it's within the radar range of him. So you can, like, I guess, hypnotize them over the radio. But you can upgrade him to a king, which says something creepy about what he's doing to the queen in order to become the to king of the entire fucking underwater world. But you can upgrade him to a king, and his ability is that in any fight you're in, your submarines kill one of every three enemy drillers, which is a huge fucking bonus, because you're essentially guaranteed to kill a third of any driller army you go up against before it even calculates the mathematics of how many drillers you had. The downside to it is that it decreases the energy of the shields of every outpost you've got by 20, which is a huge disadvantage. But then that stacks. So if you can then get a second Hypnotist and get a second king, which says weird things about the regal system of this fucking underground corporate society, what the hell. In which case, now you kill two-thirds of any enemy driller army that you go up against just automatically, regardless of the maths. And if you're, say, if you've already got one king and most of your outposts now have no shields, then doing a two king, zero shield sort of strategy is incredibly effective if you just don't care about offense.
Presumably you get a third king and
you can, yeah, you can get a third king. But that was pretty difficult to get to that stage over the course of it. But there were players basically who had nothing else to lose, because they weren't going to win and parts of the territory had been eaten away by enemies. And so they just had a strategy based around, I'm going to get two kings and then I'm going to go on the warpath and fuck up my enemies. And that was really interesting. There was other things, like there's a martyr specialist who, in any combat she's involved in, she explodes and just destroys outposts. It's the only thing that can just literally destroy an outpost and wipe it off the map completely. And it's really difficult to get that martyr close to an outpost, because if anyone sees it coming, they'll just send submarines the other way and fight you in the water, and you'll blow up harmlessly between outposts.
If they pass in the night, they attack each other.
Yes. And the only way to do that is to, you're essentially just sending subs between two outposts in opposite directions. Yeah. You can't specifically target a submarine unless you've got a pirate specialist, which travels at double speed and can target any submarine, which is pretty cool in itself. But that difficulty of getting a martyr close to an outpost means you need to be really sneaky about it. And so people do things like sending it as a gift to another player on a distant outpost miles away, so that it doesn't look like it's going anywhere particular and it looks like it's a gift. But actually what they've done is they've plotted a route, so it's going to an outpost where halfway along that route it will pass the outpost they actually want to destroy, and then they have another player send a sub to attack it at that point. So that as it's sailing past an outpost towards its supposed destination as a gift, it swings by, is attacked by another submarine, and explodes in the water. And
oh, so it's just like a blast radius thing. So it wasn't targeting that outpost to still destroy it.
It's like a third of its radar range or something like that, is its blast radius.
Our friends Matt Lees and Quinton Smith and...
Philippa Warren.
Did a round of this for Cool Ghosts.
It's ongoing, I think.
Still going on? Holy shit.
Yeah, Matt divided it up into lots of little bits.
Oh, the game itself is over, isn't it?
So much betrayal. Yeah, the game's over.
But I was going to say, Matt and Quinn's had a face-off where it's presented as just their individual like video diary things. And there's a sequence in which, because of the mechanics of gifts and queens and I think a martyr... and something else, Matt is completely sure he's going to literally destroy Quinn's, like kill his queen, which is, I think, the vital unit. Like, if you lose your queen, the whole game's over.
You're eliminated.
You're out of the game. And so he thinks he's going to wipe out Quinn's. Quinn's is completely sure this isn't going to happen because he thinks that he knows something Matt doesn't about the mechanics of it. And when Matt realizes what Quinn's thinks is going to happen, he has another answer to that and thinks that his thing overrides that. And then Quinn's doesn't know... like a fifth thing. It just gets ridiculously elaborate. I can't remember any of the actual mechanics of it, but it comes down to like a really obscure technicality about what happens if the station you were going to is already destroyed, what becomes of the fleet you sent if there's a queen aboard and stuff like that. But it's really cool.
It does an incredibly good job. Like, Neptune's Pride had a really simple mathematical combat system as well, so you could predict whether you were going to win a battle before it happened. And Subterfuge takes that one step further in that you can wind forward and backward time, so you can scrub through the timeline to just see what is the outcome of all my current moves in 12 hours time, 36 hours time, whatever. But that's based on your present knowledge, and so it's frequently incorrect. You'll scrub forward and say, okay, in 8 hours my subs are going to arrive at that outpost and win, but what you don't know is that somewhere beyond your radar range, two other people have already sent subs to that outpost, which will actually arrive before your subs and will reinforce it or capture it for their side or whatever else.
Presumably it assumes everyone is going to sort of carry on doing what they're currently doing. So if someone changes something, you know, from a gift to an attack or redirect something, doesn't know about that.
Yeah, like you can't change a gift to an attack, but you can change an attack to a gift. Which means that you can sneakily gift things to other players without maybe anyone noticing, or at least not noticing it to the very last second. Like, if you do it the 10 minutes before, it just switches to a gift. And you can queue that stuff up in advance, because you can wind forward 5 hours, give an order, and then that order won't be fulfilled till 5 hours. And so that kind of negates the Neptune's Pride thing of the person who wins is the person who's willing to sit up till all the other MSN icons tick to offline so you know that everyone else is asleep, because you can just set orders to go overnight. But it also causes these kind of constant twists and dramas and stuff like that. And the one guy I attacked was a player called Depth Sarge, who... more like I say, I wanted to do a no betrayal playthrough, not a no attack playthrough, which I think would be impossible. And I wanted the mines he had and the generators he had. And he was mounting a huge force directly on my border. And so I attacked him first. And he was the only person I attacked. And I more or less wiped him out. I got him down to, I think he only had 4 outposts left. And I, at that point, had like 15 or 16 outposts. But just through clever management of his specialists, he was able to fight his way back out of that corner and get back up to like 5, 6, 7 outposts, to the point where in the moments before I won, like if the game had gone on look, 30, 40 minutes longer, Diptharge would have captured one of my mains. Another player called Estelle would have captured one of my mains. I think a player called Spad would have held out long enough and he would have won. And so you're constantly getting all these possible realities of, if this happens, then I'll win. If this happens, then I won't. And you'll talk to someone else. And based on the information that they've got, the person who it says is going to win at the top of their screen will be a different name than the one it says on your screen.
Oh,
and
really?
So if you're, you know, because it's all based on the personal information that you have. It's really, really smart design. And I was kind of preparing myself to condemn it a little bit for, because I think Neptune's Pride was great, and it made for really memorable experiences, but really memorable, intense experiences that were unpleasant in some way that no one ever wanted to repeat, and no one I know ever played a second game of Neptune's Pride, and no one I know wants to play that game again with friends. And it sounded like Subterfuge was the same way. But I played it, and it didn't have to be about social politicking and backstabbing, and the specialists are interesting enough and diverse enough, and there's so many of them that I think you can move away from the social politicking being the core of the game to it being more about the strategy of unit management and more regular game stuff, rather than now I like my friends slightly less stuff.
if there's a game mode where it just divides into two teams, just says here are the two teams and just fight, I'd actually play it, I think. It's just the betrayal aspect of it that I can't cope with. Pip, what was your experience of it?
I hated it. I absolutely hated every single second of it. I didn't betray anyone. And I didn't lie to anyone. And I didn't attack anyone. And yeah, I haven't really been watching the Cool Ghost stuff either, because I've sort of hated what it's shown me that my friends were doing behind my back, if you see what I mean. Like, not in any serious way, but just in a kind of, oh my God, I'm so naive, and, like, wide-eyed and stupid. So that was, yeah, I don't know, it was a bit of a...
You can see like their moments of realization when they realize they've been too much of a dick. Chris Pratt has one of those where he's like, I just thought it seemed logical to portray this person.
He had that against me, I think. And I was so kind of, why are you attacking me? That he reversed the attack. Like, he sent his people there and then just gave it back to me instantly and was like, oh, I made a mistake or whatever. And I had totally believed that, you know, because why wouldn't I guess? He was a friend. And he seemed nice. And then I was reading his Eurogamer write-up and I was like, on GChat, Chris Pratt, what the actual hell? And then I just got back a kind of, I can totally explain this. I tried to betray you. So, yeah, and that was
Have you ever played a game with Owen Hill?
I don't think I want to, from the tone of voice.
No, I think it would be interesting because he is the other impossibly nice person to play the games with. And we played Risk Legacy with him, which is similar in terms of you can forge temporary alliances and stuff, but ultimately someone has to win.
Yeah.
And he always kept his word. It always, like, everyone wanted to form an alliance with him because he was, like, he would always stick to it. And then we found out, like, six games in, because he played multiple games on the same board, that he thought it was an actual rule that if you'd agreed an alliance, you couldn't betray it. Which you didn't know you could. You thought it would be cheating.
I think my sister once, like, took advantage of that when we were playing Monopoly. Like, she didn't... I didn't know that you could just, like, not keep up your end of a bargain or something if you arranged a deal with another player. She absolutely screwed me over. Like, while I was out of the room getting more wine, she was just, like, made a deal with my brother. She ended up in prison, so, you know.
Might be a lesson to us all.
But yeah, and like, the thing that I found the most stressful was just sitting there, sort of, when I was in my not playing it mind space, but my phone kept buzzing with notifications like, so and so has hired a hypnotist, so and so has hired this, and I'm like, oh God, what's he doing? Or, so and so has sent a ship to do, and you're like, and you can, it's just this constant awareness that people are sort of pressing on your territory and no one means anybody any good.
My first real experience of this game was through Pip, and it was Pip re-entering a room holding her phone out and just going, Chris, why are people like this? This moment of innocence shattered.
They had burst into tears.
You did then burst into tears, but I wasn't going to say that. I think it was because of Joe Scrabbles.
Was it?
Yeah.
It was either Joe or Nels.
No, it was Nels.
Yeah.
It was Nels Anderson.
I think that might be the next Cool Ghosts installment.
Oh.
Which,
yeah, he hasn't been on it so far. I don't know if he's doing any.
It's.
Recording anything.
My experience does not go well. I think the most recent thing that it's got up to on my point of view in the Cool Ghost thing is Joe sent this massive fleet just deep into my territory at random with one of his massively fast ships, so there was nothing I could do. All I could do was, like, I think I held out my phone to you, Chris, and just showed it to you and was like, why are people like this? And my home was devastated.
I've been enjoying your array of stuffed animal avatars for all of the other players with, like, sad faces taped on them to show how miserable everyone is playing it.
Yeah, the sad face post-its. Like, I was trying to make it less traumatic and, like, not just a to-camera piece of me, like, you know, looking really sad. I didn't think anyone would want that. I thought, like, cuddly toys would have to be the way forward. Oh, man. I'm never playing that game again.
I don't think I'm ever playing it again. I think I'm just going to retire undefeated.
Do you think that you only had a good time because you won?
No, I think I was quite content with the idea that, because it looked like maybe I was going to be top three, but then over the last 24 hours, it looked like I just wasn't going to win. I was going to be second place, and I was kind of fine with that. I'd had a fun time with it. I didn't have any kind of bad experience playing it, and it didn't even consume all my life horribly in the way that Neptune's Pride did. Like, Neptune's Pride had that kind of...
Even though it's constantly on your phone, like, beeping at you.
Yeah, it was kind of, until the last, maybe the last 2 or 3 days, it picked up a lot. But up until that point, maybe just because people weren't attacking me that much of the time, it never felt like an invasive presence or a thing that I couldn't put down and forget about for long stretches of time. And I think, like I say, there's enough interesting systems in there that that's why I was enjoying it, rather than my ultimate victory of winningness.
Something that I think might have been interesting is, because if you were playing with not strangers, but sort of people that you would only have experience with online, that's probably a bit different from, because I went into that game thinking, I'm not going to trust a single thing Quinn says because that's Quinn's games. And, like, similar with Matt, I was like, he's going to overthink this, but he's going to try and do a thing. And, like, Joe and Chris were sort of more unknown, but I definitely think that that altered the dynamics, like, before we'd even got going. I think Nels was the only person I'd never even met who was playing.
There was an element, certainly, because, like, the one person who was playing who I am actually friends with is Adam from RPS, because I'd invited him into the game. And so I was prepared for that to be the one example, basically, of awkward social interactions of, we're both friends and we work together, and how's that going to change Adam's thing? Does that mean I can rely on him more or less?
Does he may yet be. He probably only just found out you won.
Well, the thing was, what ended up happening was that about 3 days into the game, Adam went on a press trip for 24 hours and then was sick for 24 hours, during which he didn't log in, and so he was auto-resigned. And so all his...
The only way to win. I mean, like, in any real sense.
That meant that your outposts don't disappear, they remain on there, and your factories even can continue to develop drillers, although it happened at such an early point in the game that the driller output was relatively small. They'll just never attack anyone, but it becomes inhibitively expensive to ever capture them. But at the same time, it's still worth doing, because you can kind of capture Adam's outposts at that point and not feel any guilt, because he's the only player that's not there. He's gone now.
Is
and
this
so,
the same as how you justified robbing those corpses in GTA Online? Like, well, the money was just there. The people had gone.
Yeah. This was my attempt to play GTA Online without committing any crimes. Can you get money without committing crimes? And the best I could come up with was, running up and stealing the dropped money from Roadkill. Which is a crime. But was the least crimey, or least actively crimey I could be. So I guess yes. I guess yes, that's the same thing with subterfuge. So, but it meant that there were basically some free, suddenly available outposts near my territory when Adam signed out. And that kind of took out any of the friend awkwardness of the game.
Thank goodness for human illness.
Yay!
You're glad he's sick. Nothing awkward about that.
On that press trip.
I asked if he wanted to go.
And I made him stay up all night writing his article. He was sick the next day.
Yeah, you take that day off, Adam.
Switch your phone off. Just disconnect.
Just chill out. We'll
He could, he's lying in bed. You can use your phone when you're in bed. You can use your phone when you're traveling on trains.
Should have played while sick.
Could have easily signed in. I think mostly I owe my victory to the people who decided that they hated other people more than they hated me. Because I hadn't attacked anyone, there were other players like Edward Frenry and James who decided to attack a player called Spad, mainly, instead of me, in the closing hours of the game, which meant that Spad, who was on track to win, fell down into second place and I took the crown.
Do you not think maybe there's an element of them knowing which one you were and thinking, if I do this wrong, I'm going to be on the next episode of the podcast, but not in a way that I necessarily aspired to be?
Well, I thought that all the way through, that these guys are going easy on me, maybe, for this reason. But then I got messages from James today saying, are you the Graham from RPS and CNC? Because there's been some debate in the Discord room about whether you're that Graham or maybe another Graham. So I don't know. Maybe that wasn't as big an impact
jokes on
as
them.
It was. Suckers.
They missed a prime opportunity to screw over Graham. The Graham.
The Graham. Yeah. What have you been playing, Chris?
I've been playing absolutely nothing that involves even a computer, so I can't really even talk about it. Because apart from still playing and liking Overwatch, the roller coaster has finished, and it has finished on like Overwatch. I haven't really played anything else, but I did compete in an X-Wing miniatures game tournament on Saturday, which I had a brilliant time at. And the only observation that's in any way relevant is that it's something about competing in real life against somebody makes me not frustrated at all when they win. Hmm. I placed as averagely as possible in that thing. It was 27 players and I came 15th, which I'm fine with. And I was fine with it. I lost 3 games. Pip was there. She saw me afterwards. I didn't seem cross.
No, it was lovely.
What have you been playing, Pip? Other than Betrayal.
I've been playing Paladins, which is Hi-Rez's mostly first-person shooter. And you run around as a team, you try and capture points, and then you escort a siege cannon thing, siege engine, whatever, to the enemy base and try and help it mash down a bunch of doors that are guarding the entrance to a vault. And the thing about the game that they have as its unique selling point is that the progression of your abilities and the sort of the leveling up that your character does over the course of a game is via a series of cards. And at the moment you just get 3 cards sort of picked at random, I think, from your collection. But then again, given that you don't start with cards and it's still giving you cards, I think there's like a lot of like wiggle room on that. But anyway, so it gives you these 3 cards once you've leveled up, and you just pick the ability that, or the utility that will hopefully fit the game that you're in the best. So it's stuff like your projectiles go 50% further, or you can move faster, or certain abilities like cover a greater area. It's that kind of thing. And at the moment it's just a casual mode that's open for proper PvP. So the game itself just sort of gives you these cards. There's no real crafting. You just sort of, sometimes you get more lucky than others. I think the only real curation that's in there at the moment is that the lower levels will give you things like maybe a movement speed increase, or, you know, they're a lot more, they're nice to have, but they're not game changing in the way that the ones that appear at maybe level 4 or 5 are. And grayed out at the moment on the match type selection screen is the crafted mode, which is where you'll be able to use pre-built decks of these cards and hopefully chain them to greater effect, or be able to sort of customize the way that you want to play a particular character and use those.
Is it like a action-y thing like TF2 sort of? Shoot people in the face.
Yes, but I haven't ever played TF2, okay. So I'm not going to be the best person to actually like tell you how that measures like, up.
It is a shooter, though. Like,
right?
Yeah.
I played Paladins a little bit at Gamescom back in August, and it's a first-person colorful shooter, but it feels like Kyra's trying to apply maybe what they learned from Smite to a first-person shooter, in that it's about progression over the course of a match as you level up, and the card stuff seemed quite clever in its design. But the thing I never had much fun with was the actual shooting. Mm. Like, none of the weapons felt nice to fire to me. Did you find that at all when you've been playing?
I've got on better with some than others, but they still don't have that that really, really rewarding feedback that you'll find in something like Destiny or I think with Halo.
Is this the tribes people?
Or Counter-Strike.
Yeah.
And so...
So I should know how to make a gun.
Yeah.
But actually, the guns in tribes are never really his point, right? Like...
Yeah, well, it's been a few launches like in tribes. A cool thing.
Yeah, but it's a rocket launcher. Like, yeah. It's the easiest type of gun to get right, because... Yeah. Anyway.
Mm. But yeah, so... It's a weird one, because at the moment I feel like it's so beta, and they're so kind of, they, when I spoke to them about it, they hadn't really committed to how a lot of the future stuff was going to develop, like the card crafting, like, you know, quite how that was going to play out, or, you know, the ranked mode type stuff. And so at the moment when I've logged in to play, it's felt a bit kind of spinning your wheels kind of thing, like, you know, getting used to the characters themselves and looking at the cards and you know, just idly theory crafting possible combinations and things, like, oh, this is one that has a, so there's a guy called Barrick who builds turrets and can erect shields, and, you know, it's that kind of thing. I think one of his cards is, because the cards are all bound to people, like they might do the same things or a similar, you know, the text will be the same, but, you know, it obviously affects things slightly differently. But and so I think one of his things is that there's a percentage chance to set something on fire when you shoot it. And then there's another card later on from his set where the thing that's on fire takes extra damage when you hit it again. And so, you know, obviously those cards have some pretty obvious synergy and...
Adding insult to fire.
And so there's like a bunch of other stuff that you can do with that. But yeah, it kind of feels like the crafted side of it will be the entire point of the game. Mm-hmm. And so without it, it's really hard to assess the game, because it's kind of about whether the small pool of people in the beta happen to be playing the way that wins the game or not, or, you know, because it's one of those ones where if people aren't in the right position, you can just lose from sheer, the other people spent longer standing on the point rather than sniping from a distance. Well, there isn't really a sniper, but you know what I mean. And so, you know, if everyone else just dribbles onto the point one by one, then you're never going to take it, and then you lose that point, and then your progress resets in that regard, and they get the siege turret, and that batters down your first door, and, you know, it's one of those things. The matches actually don't take particularly long, though, so I've found it quite easy to just dip in and out of. It's maybe 10 minutes-ish, 10, 15 minutes. But yeah, it's just one of those things where I feel like I'm not sure how it's gonna go, because it feels like it's just not the game that it is going to be, if that makes sense.
How many players is it?
It's teams of, I think it's teams of 5v5,
right? So like a MOBA,
unless something's drastically changed in the meantime. But yeah, and so also there's only 8 characters at the moment, so you get a lot of repetition. You know, like there's a lot of people who will just insta-pick a character called Cassie. And
so TF2 goes up to like 32 players and it only has 9 characters, so there's always repetition on TF2 games. And that's kind of, it's payload mode, sounds maybe similar to the sort of escorter thing to a place. And that's, if you have a big like 16 versus 16 game, or I think 12v12 is actually the official maximum, but it's kind of chaos.
Tell me about Pip.
What?
There's a character called Pip who's kind of like this, I think it's like a scientist, but also a squirrel, maybe? I don't know. I should probably have read the lore. So he throws, like, there's an explosive flask, I think, that he throws and it does AoE damage. And then there's, like, an explosive, like, adhesive thing, so it slows down in the area that it's covered, I think. And I think his ult is like this bouncy, jumpy thing. That's why I said it's mostly first person, but when you're mounted and when you're doing things like his jump and like there's a few other skills, it goes into third person. And his regular attack is like a projectile rocket thing, I think. And I say I think so much with this because I played him once and was absolutely terrible, and it was so annoying because I'm like the worst Pip player that I know.
But is Apparently Pip not considered to be very overpowered?
Well, everyone else seems to think that Pip's amazing, and that's quite pleasing when you're transcribing it from an interview and you can kind of pretend that it was about you in the first place. But yeah, it's like, it's just totally not my skill set. And the other thing that I find super confusing with that is that on the character select screen, I keep thinking that I've chosen a different character than I actually have, because it puts my actual name right next to a different thing, and it's so confusing and I get so lost.
Pip has chosen John.
Like, what? What's his skill set? That's an interesting one. You can't double up on characters and stuff, so it's the same, you know,
All Pip roster. Strats.
No, alas, that would be great. Like 10v10 Pip. Well, 5v5 Pip.
Yeah, all that Pip, all mid.
That would be good.
You also have a horse.
Yeah, obviously.
Why?
You haven't played TF2, have you?
For getting places faster via horse.
Okay.
And if someone shoots you, then
everyone
you
has a horse?
Fall off your horse.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just like an auto mount thing, like in like in Heroes of the Storm. So you just press the mount button, and after 3 seconds, you're on your horse and stuff. But I think it's, you know, like after a certain amount of like getting the invisible horse out of your pocket, getting on it,
summoning a horse is how they work.
I haven't played either of these games. This sounds weird.
It's quite MMO-y.
Yeah, how I did it basically.
Yeah. And the environments and the art style all remind me of MMOs a little bit as well. Like, it feels almost like it could be the multiplayer mode for, like, the arena multiplayer for an MMO.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And I think, like, there's a thing that they were saying about when they were designing it, that they actually had a button on the main menu that would just translate it from fantasy to sci-fi, so that they could, like, work out which one was the more fun or the one that they thought suited the game the best. So, yeah, like, that was, I think Stu, the president, was saying that it was like they basically used Smite assets for one and they used Global Agenda assets for the other one or something, and they were trying to work out like what suited it the best. But yeah, they've gone for this kind of, yeah, like that sort of cartoony but medieval-y kind of
steampunky but not,
well, like that's the to do with the lore of it, like there's, it's kind of this fantasy world but there's like traces of technology and, you know, a goblin in a mech suit kind of thing going on. But that's one of the things that they've, I've completely forgotten where
we were talking about horses.
Well,
I was just expressing surprise that they were, everyone has a horse.
Well, horses for courses, isn't it? I don't know what that means.
Oh, one of the interesting things,
means inevitably there are horses in this game.
You were saying about whether they'd been using what they'd learnt from Smite in terms of the character progression and stuff. One thing that they were saying was that, because I was asking about different maps and different game types and stuff, and they were saying about that they'd learnt from Smite that if you have a lot of incredibly different game modes, then that really splits your audience because they can't just drift from one to the other and still know exactly what's going on. Because with Smite, like, there's the main MOBA, sort of the traditional three lane, lots of jungle camps, you know, several massive important minions, neutral monsters rather, and that's one mode that's the one that's used in competitive scene. But then there's other modes that are totally different, and that if you went from the competitive one to arena, for example, you'd be like, okay, where is literally everything that I know and what am I supposed to do right now? And so with Paladins, what they're trying to do is unify it a bit better and sort of maybe make it so that it's variations on a theme, and all you need to do is learn the maps or learn, you know, what the different objectives are, and then you're set, I think. Is what they're trying to do. And yeah, but there's still so much time to go, and like the character design could stand to improve quite a lot, especially on the lady front. So
and on the lady back.
They're mostly concerned with the lady top front. It's one of those things where I spoke to them, and again, they were really kind of upfront about it and said, you know, I've chosen my words very poorly there, but saying that it was something that they were very aware of and that they wanted to sort of, you know, address with coming characters and stuff. But it's one of those things where you're just waiting to see what actually transpires from that, I guess, because at the moment it's like two ladies and six guys, and or six things that use the he pronoun, and the ladies are kind of a type, and the guys are, you know, one's a squirrel, one's like a kind of dwarf guy, another one is like this massive knight, and you know, it's one of those. Okay.
Especially a shame given how relatively well both to games in its genre and games in the industry generally Overwatch has done, relative to Blizzard's own output as well. Overwatch seems to have done pretty good things on the whole with its diversity and its lineup and diversity in body type and race and gender and so on, which is nice to see. Not 100% perfect, but far better than most, which is maybe faint praise, but... Yeah.
But yeah, so it's very much a wait and see kind of deal for me, I think.
Should we do questions?
From questions?
Yes.
Okay.
I never say that part, but someone always adds it.
Prod Stewart writes, love de Gaulle. And then there's an asterisk next to it, which explains the joke. It says, not really though, Paul is way better.
I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that means either. I've been catching up on some of the latest episodes, and that discussion of maps was very interesting. And yes, Minecraft's maps are awesome, since you have to both craft them and fill them in yourself. You've all no doubt heard that cheesy quote, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. Whoever said that would hate fast travel. It makes me sad, though, that for all the things games can do, I haven't yet encountered one that makes traveling enjoyable and exciting, or dangerous and scary, depending on what kind of place you're exploring. I want a game in which going from one small village to another through a dark forest is an enjoyable challenge, and not a chore. So I ask you, which games, past, present, or future, get traveling or exploring right? You've tried VR. Will VR make traveling more fun by making you feel more present? Do you generally enjoy exploring handcrafted or procedural environments more? Ranks for heathing, everybody. Prod Stewart.
I talked before about my first experience with Fallout 4, and my first experience with almost any Bethesda game is always an amazing example of that, where just traveling anywhere is this terrifying adventure where everything I encounter is totally unknown to me and could be fatal, and often is. Like, they're often harder games when you start out, and you hit some critical mass. And Fallout 4 now, I'm still playing it, and I'm now just almost unstoppable. I had one quest recently where a guy had a missile launcher that killed me in one hit, and that guy was tough, but everything else, it had a skull next to its name, tell you like, oh, this guy's so tough, you don't want to tangle with him, and I was just killing them all in one shot from stealth, so they never even had a chance to fight back. And so that sense of danger is totally gone for me now. But when I was just starting out, it was amazing. I don't know how or if you can balance a game such that that would continue forever, that traveling would always be this terrifying, exciting adventure. Maybe it would continue to be terrifying but stop being exciting once you've already seen all the enemy types, and then it would just be annoying that you could get killed so easily. There is a mod for Skyrim, which I still haven't tried out, but I just really want to, which I can't remember the name of, but it adds things like... just cold and wet. If you're wet and the weather gets cold, you start to lose health.
Is it called Frostfall?
Yes. And that sounds really good in terms of like making you actually think about, shit, I need to set up camp for the night and actually start a fire, or I'm going to die of cold. I've heard that Miasmata is good for this, and I think the Long Dark as well. Probably a bunch of the early access survival games are.
Miasmata has... orienteering in that you've got a paper map which can only be filled in if you can get to an elevation and then spot two landmarks on the horizon in order to be able to triangulate your position, and then like the area of the map between that triangle fills in at that point.
Oh, nice. I kind of think that if you just took the map out of Fallout 4, it would be kind of amazing. Or if the map was just a blank screen and you had to draw on it what you thought was where, like when you find somewhere cool, you just go to the map and you'd like write a note or draw something. Actually, Ultima Underworld, it did fill in the map as you went, like most modern games, but you it wouldn't tell you what anything was, so you had to write notes on the map yourself to say like orcs here and like.
I think you could do that with Spirit Tracks or Phantom Hourglass or one of the Zeldas on the DS. Yeah. Like you could annotate the maps, I think.
I think, yeah, I haven't really found one where you draw the map yourself, and I think that would be really cool.
I was actually jumping back into Elite today, because I'm getting quite excited about Horizons, and that's a game where I really like travel. I know it's completely opposite, sort of, obviously the opposite end of the technological spectrum from freezing to death in Skyrim, but I think simply, even though it's essentially repetitive moves, because we've spoken about this before, because it's repetitive, in that getting between systems is a sort of similar series of actions, you do feel like you're covering large distances, and the scale of that game is incredible. It's samey because space is samey, and I'm looking forward, even though they're not adding landing on planets with atmosphere and cities and loads of people, they're adding landing on rocks and moons. I'm actually really looking forward to that because that increased sense of scale, like I want to get in the bit where I'm just sat in my buggy on some moon thinking, I'm far as fuck from anywhere. Like, because that is really what that game offers. Like, at lunchtime, I found some really hugely profitable pair of smuggling missions, because all I do now is just move drugs around. I refuse to move slaves, but I'll move drugs, basically. That's fine. And set course for, it's just the next station system over. But the station, I think the reason they ended up paying out like 150,000 credits or something was because the station itself was one of those really big systems where you actually have to super cruise for ages just to get from the star to some distant fucking station orbiting one rock of 12 rocks orbiting a big gas giant or something. And all that stuff's procedurally generated, but it really feels weirdly like a journey when you get there, because you implicit in it, in the way it procedurally places stations, is the implicit story of who the fuck built this out here? Like, why is there a little cargo outpost just floating around some moon of some gas giant that doesn't even have a name? It's just a number a million miles away from anywhere. And there's something kind of weirdly sort of like romantic about that. Like, I think that's where, I think a lot of people sort of hover around Sol and the actual solar system. And I know that the Elite Horizons beta, which is beginning this week, I think the hub is going to be Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter. And so the solar system is going to again become this kind of big hub of activity. There'll be traffic jams on Europa kind of thing. But for me, that game is absolutely about being out in the middle of fucking nowhere, where there's a small number of people, and you kind of sense like, what must it be like? Like, what would it be like to grow up on on some sort of orbital around nothing? Which is I'm attracted to because I'm from Wiltshire.
I sometimes feel like it sounds on the podcast like I've only ever played two games, but one of those games is Neo Scavenger.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Truck Simulator.
Oh,
or OMSI.
Yeah. I thought he was going to say Football Manager. What?
Hey, I've played lots of games. I was thinking that the other game was Mask, because that's the one that I was bringing up in response to questions.
I think Mask's in the same gray box as Neo Scavenger for me.
But when he says, you know, how do you make traveling through a forest feel interesting and dangerous every single time, that's Neo Scavenger for me, where it's an RPG with fixed locations on the map, where those fixed locations have scripted stories and quests and stuff, but all the spaces in between are procedurally generated with dynamically placed items and enemies, and where you don't know whether you're going to go into the forest and be confronted by a man with a bat or a man with a shotgun, and maybe the shotgun's not loaded, or whether you're going to find some mushrooms you can eat, or whether you're just going to find some poisonous mushrooms that are going to cause you to die 2 days later of some horrible vomiting disease.
In real life.
Yeah. I just feel like it makes for a really exciting experience every time you travel across that map.
I think it's the qualifier that they've got of like wanting it to be a fun, challenging experience, because there's plenty of stuff that where I've actually found the moving around or exploring fun, but it's not been for challenge reasons. Like in Ocarina of Time, I think that's probably my favorite movement of anything, is just being on my horse and riding around the field and stuff. And that was amazing. And then in Majora's Mask, there's a mask that you put on and become one of the creatures that can roll around really fast, and you can like get up massive amounts of speed on the field that's just outside the main town. And like with Proteus as well, just like wandering around and just seeing really cool things, or experiencing, you know, like the little noises that are different to noises you've heard before and indicate that you're about to see something that you haven't seen before and stuff. But I guess the ones that I've heard people say that are like really amazing but challenging are stuff, yeah, like what you were saying, like Sims, like Euro Truck Simulator, or I wrote a while ago about VATSIM, which is the service that connects people who use flying simulators to people who are playing the role of
air traffic control.
And so that's all about the challenge of the travel to and from, or, you know, navigating particular things. And some of it is obviously going to be quite sort of, I guess, samey, or, you know, you shift into that driving long distance
literally
kind of
a job.
Mode. But then when you come to actually land, like, there's all of the challenges and all of the, you know, things that you have to take into consideration for that. And the last one, I guess, is just people wax lyrical about Dark Souls and about exploring that world and moving around it and learning it.
Apparently it's fucking great.
How meaningful it is.
I totally don't get it, and I hate that game. But yeah, like people sort of speak about it as if they're almost caressing the world with their thoughts. And so I think that probably
lovely
Lord Ran.
The lovely land of lords.
The fun, challenging.
I would love to have the experience that other people have from playing Dark Souls, but I have played Dark Souls, and I'm not going to have that experience. Two things I hate most in games are boss fights and repetition. So,
Alice loved it, though.
Eric writes, "Hey, Loda Ok Kufit? I think Kufut. Loda Ok Kufut. That's hi, Kreting Crowbar in Swedish, written in approximate English phonemes. I looked it up, and I don't think he's just made me say anything rude. What are your views on the different ways to present a dialogue between a player and an NPC? It came to mind because Fallout 4 and Skyrim took different stances. In Skyrim, you choose between full texts of what you can say and instantly hear a voiced response. In Fallout, you choose one of four representations of ways to respond and hear your character say a thing that hopefully corresponds. Sean Vanneman on Idle Thumbs made the point that the earlier method makes any conventional drama impossible, but of course the latter really distances the player from the player character. I would love to hear your opinions. Tack för att ni läste allihopa.
That one,
I think Graham's broken.
I assume that's thanks for listening, everybody.
I'm assuming so. I'm hoping so, somewhat.
We have a really interesting case study for this because Fallout 4, as he says, gives you these four very vague dialogue options. Like, one of them is often sarcastic, question mark, and one of them would be something like, your face, question mark. One of them, like, someone killed someone else in front of me, and one of my dialogue options was, you killed him. what is that dialogue option? I need to see what you'd actually say about it, because in what sense am I saying you killed him? Am I just...
You killed him.
Just
you
check. Was that, is he now dead? Or am I saying, you bastard, you killed him, or what? But there is a mod that replaces those with the full text of what you're going to say, which is...
way better.
I assume there must be... I don't think they've written it all out. I assume that information is in the game files, yeah, in some way to just pull it in. And yeah, with that installed, it's just like night and day difference. It's so much better. It's just making me so much more engaged with the conversation. Because I can't, if I don't know what my character's going to say, I just can't get that invested in them. Because on a regular basis, they're going to say something that I think, I wouldn't have said that. I didn't know they were going to say that. That's just dumb.
It's the same thing that happened in L.A. Noire, when you'd think you were going to pick something and then your character would properly flip out and just sort of get right up in someone's face and have a go at them. And you're like, I thought that was a far milder option than it turned out to be.
Yeah, there's the problem is, I think the mistake a lot of... So it might just be for practicality reasons. Someone posted a screenshot from Fallout 4 with this mod installed that made Fallout 4 look ridiculous in a way that they couldn't have done without that mod, which was the four options were something like, oh, so where do we go? Is it this address? And then the other one was like, oh, okay, I guess we'll go there at this address. And then the other one was like, I guess you're going to say we need to go to this address. So they all had they were 90% the same. It's just the first few words are different. And if you're going to spell out every option, you can't do that because it looks too fake to them or looks weird to the player. Mm. So maybe it's for necessity, but I think if it's a stylistic choice, if people, you know, could do either and they've decided to do this one, I think the mistake they're making is that they think for the player, what matters is what kind of attitude you have, whether you are sarcastic or whether you are inquisitive or whether you are assertive. But for me personally as a player, and I think for a lot of people, the actual phrasing of that option is massively important. Because if it's a joke and it's not funny, I don't want to say the joke. Of course I don't want to say the joke. It matters hugely whether the joke is actually witty. And that you can only know that if you know every single word you're going to say. And you can't... I will just never pick the joke option if you don't tell me exactly what I'm going to say. And I'll never pick the sarcastic option if you don't tell me exactly what I'm going to say. What am I being sarcastic about? What is the joke? Is it funny? And same for, like, hostile options. So before this mod, I would just pick the most boring default options, basically, because I just couldn't be sure what my character was going to do. And now that I see the full text of some of the jerk options, I'm picking them much more often because I realize that's quite a funny thing to say.
I feel exactly the same way about this, Tom. That mod is basically essential, I think. There's a really good example of a time where you were given an opportunity to pick a final conversation option for a conversation that is about to become a fight. And it's going to become a fight one way or another. And one of the options, and I have no idea how they present this under the kind of giving you an abstract sense, but and you can see the full lines, one of them is notably far, far, far longer than the others. It's practically in this sort of almost a speech. Like it's, you know, the others are like, we'll fight now, or I wish we didn't have to fight, or you're already dead. And then one of them is like this Inigo Montoya, you know, running thing. But the way the game does it is once you've picked that conversation option, you can start moving because it does let you move in those conversations and go back to the first person, even when it's cutting to the third person. And you can start moving and you can start doing things in the open world and your character will keep talking to finish the line. And then the fight starts the moment you finish saying the line. So there's weirdly an incentive to picking the longest possible line because it allows you to run around the room you're about to fight in, just planting mines in front of people while monologuing on the subject of the violence you're about to do, or buffing yourself or getting into better cover or whatever. Because the first time I did that, I died. Having just said something like, let's get this over with. But I didn't actually really want to get it over with. I'm just going to keep talking for a bit so that, you know, we really will fight, but we're going to fight in a moment because right now what I need to do is totally move to behind this bookcase because your guy over there is about to shoot me with a thing and I don't really want that to happen. So I'm going to put a bottle cap mine at his feet and then stand behind this cabinet. Anyway, I'm done now. Go.
This is like the Fallout filibuster.
Yeah, exactly.
You're filibustering where, like, you don't have to yield the floor until you've actually finished speaking. So people who want to, like, stop a bill will just keep talking continuously for, like, 8 hours at a stretch until the deadline has passed, and then the bill can't be passed anyway. Just get around combat that way.
Yeah.
Mm. I feel like I'm not really allowed to pitch in on this one because I enjoyed the conversation options in Oblivion. And that was the, you know, that weird quartered circle where you sort of just looked at the person's facial expressions.
Oh, the persuasion thing.
Distasteful they found whatever you were
but
saying.
You had, you had to do like joke, compliment, insult.
Yeah. Oh, it was the best thing ever. It was the easiest way to interact with people I've ever found. And I just, we should all go back to that. I could do that.
But it's basically, there is a way of changing it. It would be like, Graham, nice t-shirt. Only joking. It's shit. Like, that's one journey around the, like, four thirds.
What was it? It was
three quarters.
There was, like, joke, insult, compliment, intimidate or something.
It's
yeah.
Thing,
yeah. So
everyone you had to intimidate.
So it would be, so it would be, nice shirt, only joking, it's shit,
but
I'm going to kill
you.
Because the wheel was always set up so that one of them had the least strength that you applied to that option. So you'd find the thing that pleased them the most and the thing that upset them the most and try desperately to, like, angle the wheel so that you could play all four options and come out with the least
strength.
Like,
know that
outcome.
The next thing you're going to say is going to be really strong, and you can't control that, so you have to angle it to the thing that's going to be least offensive.
But that to me feels like an element where real life could learn from video games, because quite frankly, it's
maybe you
really
should all tell me what you want me to say.
What people want.
I know the next thing I'm going to say is going to be really vermin. I love your shoes.
Well, Pip, I like compliments, and I don't like intimidation.
I'll bear that in mind.
Yeah, but you have to be intimidated slightly as part of going around the wheel.
When you're
going
to intimidate me, just do as little as possible.
I'm just going to, like, nudge you, like, in an annoying
fashion.
Your sock. Yeah, yeah. Or, like, flick you in the forehead or something, you know?
I'm going to mess with your phone.
Sean writes, "Dear Steak and Cowbell, with the highly anticipated release of Just Cause 3 this week, I was reminded of my oh-so-short and unhappy interaction with its predecessor. In the opening set piece of Just Cause 2, you parachute down to the exterior of a military complex and the player is tasked with infiltrating the base. Armed with the game's signature grappling hook, I took aim at a patrolling guard in an elevated position and hit him squarely in the chest. He was subsequently dragged over the precipice of a 60-foot drop and tumbled face-first into the frozen ground. Moments later, rather than expiring, as the in-game tutorial must have anticipated, the guard dusted himself off and continued on patrolling, apparently unconcerned by the incident which had just befallen him. Bewildered, I fired the grappling hook again, dragging the dutiful soldier to within feet of my own position. Again, he picked himself up, composure restored, and continued on his way. Unwilling to be ignored, I ran right into his line of sight, expecting a hail of bullets at any moment. They never came. The soldier was totally committed to denying my existence. He just walked right by me. This treatment made me oddly frustrated, and soon I found myself quitting the game. I'm not sure I want to go back to Just Cause 2. It sounds weird, but my first interaction in the game felt so discordant that I was repelled from further participation in that world. My question to you fine folks is, has a broken mechanic ever caused you to quit a game for good? Did an individual moment of dissonance jar you out of the enjoyment you felt for a game? Bonus points if you endured less time than the 8 minutes I lasted in Just Cause 2. Thanks for the excellent pod. I started backing you on Patreon recently, and I look forward to Friday afternoons all the more with your show in my ears. Regards, Sean McKenna."
Oh,
thank you very much.
I don't have quite an equivalent to that. It's also worth just saying to this person that intro to Just Cause 2 is kind of awful, and the game gets way better after that. The intro to all of the Just Cause games is a very scripted tutorial thing. They all involve a mounted gun. They're all that kind of bullshit. And then they let you out into the open world, and it's a different game.
But ultimately an empty one, according to
I mean, I've liked the two that I've played thoroughly, and like a lot. And the third one I haven't played thoroughly enough to know whether I like it yet or not. But this isn't quite the same, but there is, like, when I mentioned, like, one mechanic really pissing you off, every time I play Nuclear Throne, the reason I quit is always the end-of-level vortex. So Nuclear Throne is a randomized top-down shooter where you have to murder all the crazy wasteland mutants, and then once you kill them all, a vortex appears near your location and sucks you in to the next level. And it has a like an attractive, it's like a gravity well, and the closer you are to it, the stronger it attracts you. But it happens when you kill the last enemy, and so there can be weapons and loot all over the place. Like, sometimes the reason you killed the last enemy wasn't to finish the level, it was because they were about to kill you and you had to kill them. And there might be a really cool weapon, like, 6 feet away from you, away from where the portal happens to spawn, and there's just no way to overcome the force of the portal sucking you in, so you get taken to the next level knowing there was loot right there that you could have picked up. And it's a game mechanic intentionally. It's supposed to be a challenge, and you're supposed to think ahead, and you're supposed to realize, oh, this is the last enemy, I need to make sure I get everything before I kill them, or when I do kill them, I'm far enough away that... Actually, I don't know if that works, because I don't think the vortex happens at their location. I think it always happens near you. I'm not totally sure. But it's... The problem with it is that, I mean, A, most of the time I just forget, and I just didn't know it was the last enemy, and so I kill him when he's really close to me, and I get sucked into the vortex, and I lose the out on the weapon. And every time it's so mechanics-y, there's no natural reason for it to work that way. It's so gamey that the fact that it costs me something truly vital, I mean, it's to the point where I almost, you know, think it would be easier to just start again at this point, because I missed out on the, like... a really good weapon on level 2, and if I don't have that now, I'm going to do worse on subsequent levels. And it's like Spelunky, where if you don't getting a cool item early on is really, really important. And yeah, every time that I've quit the game, it's been because of that. The reason, when I do remember that this is going to happen, I don't like it much still, because what it incentivizes me to do is just like find the first easiest enemy and just walk straight past them and leave them there, and then kill everyone else. And then just know that one guy's there. And I can do that, and it's all right. You know, you have to dodge a couple of weak, slow shots, and then just play the rest of the game normally, just killing everyone whenever you like, and then come back to that one guy and kill him when you're totally ready. And I can do that, but then you would never design the game to make that the way you have to play. So it sucks that that's the best way to play, as far as I know.
Yeah. I always found the same thing with Nucleophron.
They did, it's worth saying, in the recent update, they did reduce the force of that thing, and I've played it since then, and I found it to be still annoying.
And that's all the time for questions that we have.
If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, you can do so by emailing questions at createandcrowbar.com, or you can leave a question on the forum at createandcrowbar.com/forum. You can also tweet us questions at createandcrowbar. And if you'd like to discuss this episode on Discord, which was mentioned earlier as the source for Graham's Neptune's
Subterfuge
game, I almost said Nuclear Throne. And then I said, yeah, anyway, you can find that, well, the special link, they'll give you an invite, which you can find either on the right-hand sidebar of the main site or in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to follow us as individuals on Twitter, I'm C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Tom?
I'm at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
Graham?
I'm at Gonnas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
And finally, Special Pip?
I really wish I'd chosen a different Twitter name now. I spell it all out. I'm at Philippa War, which is P-H-I-L-I-P-P-A-W-A-R-R.
Philippa War.
One L, two P's, two R's.
Yeah. I don't know why I was counting down on my fingers. I
know it's 13 letters.
Thanks for listening, everybody.